Well, thank you, and yeah, don't worry about the aluminum. The one thing they found about Alzheimer's and dementia, lots of physical exercise and lots of mental exercise. That's why I got Kathy to go on this rugged vacation with me. I just said, hey, you know, if you want to prevent mental deficiencies, just says it was the most strenuous vacation she's ever been on, but said, hey, it's great to be fit.
One way I prevent mental deficiency is saying people's names backwards.
Well, you can do that, or you can come to this class, right?
Yeah, I do.
You can get some good mental exercise. There's another way of doing it.
Yep.
Hey, I want to encourage all of you to follow Ross Hoagland's example. I mean, kind of what he did is he said, hey, we got this video series, and we're available to teach a class. Just let a few people know, and hey, an opportunity develops. So appreciate you guys taking that kind of initiative, but they gave us a good example we can all follow. So this Sunday and two Sundays ago, I was speaking at Lake Avenue Congregational Church, so that's why I was a few minutes later than usual coming to this class, and I think a few of you are still coming in, so because I have a whole bunch of our people over there to continue fielding questions. But a lot of people over there and here are asking, where can we get the talk? And the talk I gave 2 weeks ago, it's on our paradoxes.org website. The entire video plus all the visuals, it's all there. So I think it's there, right? You got it up there? Good. So I told everybody at Lake Avenue, go to paradoxes.org, you'll find it. So I'm glad it's there. I did not get a chance to record today, but I don't think it's necessary because it's essentially the same message I gave at Willow Creek Community Church, Cosmic Fingerprints, and there you can get the DVD, which has everything in it, although it is missing some of the latest updates, but I just didn't have time to set up the recording this morning. That's what happens when you've been there once. Everybody was asking me questions while I was trying to set up, but it all worked out. I don't remember whether I told you about this book, Alone in the Universe. Did I ever mention this? I did. Okay, so I won't mention that again. And we'll jump right into this. Let's see if I can get this up here. See if we can wrap up this section on human origins. So I'll bring a new scientific discovery next week, but hey, let's see if we can make some progress here. And in fact, it was just this past week we spent an entire day with several of the most prominent theistic evolution leaders in the country. And one of the reasons why they're persuaded that human beings are not the product of special creation, however, with one exception, their position is that the spirit within us is something that God supernaturally imposed. But in terms of our body and the way we relate in terms of our mind, our will and emotions, that's the product of natural descent. And one of the arguments that they claim proves that, or at least strongly suggests that, is vitamin C. And referring to a deficiency within human beings. That most animals, most of the higher animals, make their own vitamin C. We don't. Likewise, the great apes don't make their own vitamin C. And the argument is that the common ancestor of the great apes, and for that matter, they think this is also true of Neanderthals and Homo erectus and the Australopithecines and all the rest of the bipedal primate species, that there was a genetic accident that happened millions of years ago whereby the common ancestor of human beings, the great apes, Neanderthals, Homo erectus, etc., lost their ability to manufacture their own vitamin C. And so they look at our inability to manufacture vitamin C as a deficiency, and they blame that deficiency on a mutation accident that took place in the common ancestor of human beings and the great apes. So that's their explanation for why we don't make our own vitamin C. What they're overlooking, however, and this is actually part of our discussion that we had a few days ago, is that what you see in human beings and the great apes is that we have sophisticated biochemical mechanisms in our body to recycle vitamin C that the species that make their own vitamin C don't possess. So it's not like these other species make their own vitamin C and we don't. Is that they make their own vitamin C but have no mechanism to recycle it. We don't make our own vitamin C, but we have these sophisticated mechanisms that recycle the vitamin C. Because you look at animals that do manufacture vitamin C, they manufacture a whole lot. And the reason why they have to manufacture so much is that there's no mechanism in their bodies to recycle the vitamin C. Whereas in our bodies are bathed with a lot less vitamin C. But the reason that we can get away with having less vitamin C in our bodies is that we have these mechanisms that recycle the vitamin C. So instead of the vitamin C just simply being excreted, it actually gets recycled through our bodies. Which means that what human beings and the great apes are able to do is survive on a lot less vitamin C. We don't have to have tens of thousands of units of vitamin C flooding through our bodies because we recycle the 500 to 1,000 to 1,500 units of vitamin C. And so we can maintain the vitamin C we need for healthy living with much less vitamin C. And by the way, it's not just the great apes and human beings that have this capability, and presumably also the bipedal primates that are now extinct. We also see it in guinea pigs. They can't manufacture their own vitamin C. But just like with us human beings and the great apes, they have the same sophisticated mechanisms for recycling the vitamin C. And therefore, they don't have to be consuming huge amounts of vitamin C in order to maintain health. Now you say, why would you want that in the great apes and human beings and not have it, say, in dogs and cats? We live longer. The great apes live longer. And because we live longer, there would be damage to our internal organs if our organs were being bathed with 20, 40, 50,000 units of vitamin C. And so, to give you an example, those of you that are older may remember, who's that fellow that won two Nobel Prizes? Linus Pauling. And he was famous for pushing vitamin C at mega dose levels and claimed that it prevented him from getting colds, etc. Well, Linus Pauling's no longer with us. And I'm not saying this was the cause of his death. But what they have discovered since is that if you load up with too much vitamin C, it actually makes the small capillaries in your brain bleed. And so it causes very low levels of brain damage, but it can accumulate over time. Now, if you're talking about an animal that lives only 8 or 9 years, it's not going to make any difference because the damage takes place over many decades. But guess what? We live many decades. And likewise, chimpanzees live 40, 50, 60 years. And so it's crucial that they have mechanisms that are able to take the vitamin C that they consume and then are able to recycle it at levels that are not going to be damaging to the internal organs over the space of several decades. And the whole point is, I don't think it's an evolutionary accident that caused humans, simians, and guinea pigs, and fruit-eating bats to lose the ability to make vitamin C. And there's another factor here. Notice the list of these species here. These are species that live in environments where it's very difficult not to consume vitamin C. I mean, so like fruit-eating bats. And guess what? Fruit's loaded with vitamin C. So they're going to get their vitamin C. And the other thing that scientists have observed is that when simians, by the way, just a word for the great apes, is that humans, simians, and the guinea pigs also seem to be able to figure out which foods are vitamin C rich. And they have this natural desire to consume this stuff, whereas you don't see that in the other animals that don't make their own vitamin C. So, for example, rabbits really don't pursue foods that are rich in vitamin C. You won't see them doing that. But if you look at the behavior of a guinea pig, they just seem to have a sense of knowing which vegetables out there are rich in vitamin C and which ones aren't. And they have this real desire to consume that kind of food. And, you know, our family, we got to see this firsthand because, you know, when our boys were younger, they were not content with two or three species of pets. They wanted to have at least two dozen different species of pets. And, you know, I admire my wife. She actually tolerated all these weird creatures that we had in our house. But we did have guinea pigs for a while. And the thing that amazed my sons is that the guinea pigs could spot vitamin C from about 40 or 50 feet away. They just seemed to know when we came home with the appropriate vegetables rich in vitamin C. And really, as soon as I opened the car door in our garage, the guinea pigs would start screaming at us. They wanted that broccoli. I mean, they just seemed to know that there was broccoli in our grocery bag, and they wouldn't shut up until they got some. Well, as you know, broccoli is vitamin C rich. But when we would bring home vegetables that didn't have vitamin C in it, we didn't get a squawk at all from the guinea pig. He was just sitting there. But they just seemed to know which vegetables out there had that stuff in it. So, you know, spinach they would squawk for. You know, I got to learn which vegetables were vitamin C rich just by listening to the guinea pig. And I tried to point out to my sons, you know, see what they like? That's what you should be. Didn't work quite as well, but it is true. I mean, if you watch simians in the wild, they seem to have this desire of noticing which foods are vitamin C rich, and they make it a point to eat that stuff. You know, their mothers didn't tell them. They just seem to have that as an inborn sense. And so the argument that we're making responds to this idea that we must be the product of common descent because we share a defect is, I don't think this is a defect. In fact, my colleague Fuzz Ron has written several articles on this that you'll find at our reasons.org website, where he makes the point that if you look at the level of design in the creatures that don't make their vitamin C compared to those that do, those that don't are manifesting a much more sophisticated level of design and the way their metabolic systems are set up than those creatures that don't make their vitamin C. And so it's not an evolutionary accident. It's actually evidence for direct divine intervention that he has set up these mechanisms within their bodies where they can recycle the vitamin C in such a way that the internal organs don't get damaged. Now, one thing Fuzz has pointed out, he says that's simply the only factor that we know so far about the advantages of not manufacturing our own vitamin C. He says there's probably a lot more. And the point he's making here is, like with so much in terms of this debate, you know, are there accidents of evolution that are embedded in the species, the human species? And actually, you know, their point is this. We're the last species that has shown up on the history of life on planet Earth. And so if we are the product of common descent, then of all species, we should have a very heavy accumulation of, you know, accidents and defects in our body, because if these are accumulated over time and it's common descent, then we should have the most. However, and that explains why people thought, well, the adenoids are a product of they're an accident. They don't serve any purpose. Likewise, I remember as a child where they thought that the appendix was a useless organ that was a product of common descent and evolutionary accidents. Today we know that the appendix indeed serves no purpose in digestion, but it does serve a crucial role in the immune response system. And so when I was a child, if you had abdominal surgery, they always took out your appendix. They said, this is useless, you don't need it. Let's get rid of it. And it'll save an operation down the road. Today, they no longer do that because they realized they were mistaken in thinking it served no purpose. And also, I can remember as a child, in our public school, They sent a letter home to all the parents saying, we need to take out your child's adenoids and tonsils. And so, but my mother was a nurse, and she said, you're not taking out the tonsils and adenoids of my son. Well, I was the only kid in my class that didn't have the tonsils and adenoids removed. I still have them. And it took another 20 years, but we now know that the tonsils and adenoids also play a role in the human immune response system. So today, the public schools don't routinely take out the adenoids and tonsils of all the kids in the classroom. And there's also an appreciation that the human backbone isn't as bad as we thought it was. I remember being taught in the public schools of Canada that we must be the product of common descent because we have this messed up backbone. It's got this curvature in it, and it's really not appropriate. We could have a much better designed backbone for standing, for example, or running. Well, we now know that, yes, you could redesign the human backbone in such a way that it would be able to run better or stand better. But the thing we now notice is that humans are unique amongst all species, and that at least in the 21st century, numbers of us spend 8, 10, 12 hours a day sitting in a chair looking at a screen or playing video games or whatever. I mean, it depends whether you're gainfully employed or not. But whether you're gainfully employed or not, it seems like a lot of us spend a lot of time sitting down. And that's one of the great challenges of backbone structure, is to design a backbone in such a way that it can handle long periods of standing, long periods of walking, running, lying down, or sitting. And it's the human backbone that's able to accommodate all. Not that we couldn't have a backbone that would be better designed for sitting, for standing, and running, but we have a backbone that can do all and tolerate all at a high level of high level of a time commitment to those activities. But I remember as a child being said, hey, we have this little tailbone structure. That means that we once had a really long tail and just got shorter and shorter as a result of evolution. Well, today we know that we call the tailbone really does play a crucial role in enabling the human back to be able to do all those things. Not that we don't have some issues with our backs, okay? I would guess that most of the older men here in the audience have had back issues. But a lot of that is due to the fact that the human male population today, especially those of us that are Caucasian, tend to be tall. And it is true that the human species has gotten taller and taller over the centuries, and it's especially tall men, and especially tall men that are not doing a lot of activity that wind up having back issues. And hey, I got back problems when I was writing my first book because I made the mistake of sitting too long for too long of a period of time. You want good back health, you don't want to be doing, because the backbone is designed to do all of these things, sitting, running, standing, lying down. It's a good idea to make sure that your daily routine has all of the above. And so what I appreciate about the scholars at Reasons to Believe is we have set things up where their desk allows them to sit at their computer or stand at their computer. So we actually have desks at two levels. And so what we encourage them to do is, spend some time standing at your computer doing your work and spend some time sitting down. That's one way to save some money on our, workman's compensation.
Yeah,
so,
save workman's comp.
Right. Well, we're now in a low category of workman's compensation because there just hasn't been any claims being distributed. That's actually saved us some money. So the money we spent setting up special desks for him is actually paid off. So, yeah, that's a little bit off the subject. But it does lead into this whole debate about, okay, are we looking at crippled designs? Are we looking at accidents of evolution that have accumulated over time? Or are we simply not seeing a design that's there? And this is where Fuzz has stepped in and saying, I think we're just seeing the tip of the iceberg when it comes to vitamin C. Because really the one area of understanding is too much vitamin C in certain situations is not a good thing. But maybe there are other reasons we haven't explored yet. And his whole point is, if you assume that this is the product of divine design, then you'll be motivated to research and study and look, and you should expect that not all the design is going to be easy to uncover. But it's a great way to test. This is what was so valuable about the discussion we had a couple of days ago with some of these leaders of evolutionary creationism and theistic evolution. This is an area where we can test our differences. You know, they believe in common descent. If it's common descent, then there should be some, you know, crippled designs and some junk that's been accumulated over time. And if it's not common descent, then that should be at a minimal level. But one of the things we pointed out is it shouldn't be at a zero level. It should be at a minimal level. And the whole point here is, if you look at Romans chapter 8, it says that the entire creation is subject to the law of decay. So given that the human species has been around for 50, 60, 70,000 years, and by the way, this is also part of our discussion a few days ago about the dates. And one of the things we talked about is within the theistic evolution camp, there's this belief that the dates we have for human origins and human history are really accurate. But if you actually read the scientific literature, in fact, I'm trying to remember the guy's name, but he wrote a paper in Nature where he said, you know, when it comes to molecular clocks, they're really not timekeeping devices. It's not like it's a watch. It's more like it's a sundial. You get an approximation. And so when we throw out dates like, 50, 60, 70,000 years, or in some cases the DNA dates are coming in 150,000 years, they just did a recalculation of Y chromosome where they're saying instead of 42,000 years ago for the first man, looks like it's 146,000 years ago. Bottom line is that when you're using DNA, it's extremely complex, and the dates simply are not that good. And, the evidence is that when people do research, the dates can vary by a factor of five. And likewise, when you're trying to date human origins with respect to cultural origins, that's better, but it's still a problem. You know, in terms of trying to date when clothing first began to be used, because that's one thing that does distinguish human beings. We're the only species that wears clothes, at least willingly. So, Neanderthals did not wear clothes. Homo erectus did not wear clothes. We wore clothes, and moreover, it looks like we're wearing clothes right away. In fact, you actually see that in the book of Genesis, that it wasn't long before humans were wearing clothes. And that shows up in the cultural dates. And, you know, those dates are coming in at about 50,000 years ago from when clothing first began to appear. Likewise, advanced art, the earliest evidence we have is that cave in France 33,000 years ago, where you see sophisticated art in the cave walls. Music goes back about 40,000 years. Complex language, about 40,000 years. Jewelry. We're the only species that wears jewelry. We don't see that, and again, I'm saying willingly. I mean, people put jewelry on their dogs, but the dogs tolerate it. They don't really. It's not something they would do on their own. But we also see a jewelry big bang. In fact, they call these things the cultural big bangs, where you just see a big bang of jewelry use, clothing use, advanced tools, art, music. But I want to remind you, the dates are not that accurate. And the problem is that carbon-14 dating begins to peter out when you get older than about 30,000 years. Carbon-14 has a half-life of 5,715 years. And the rule of thumb for any radiometric dating method, it's reliable where you're within a factor of 6 times of the half-life. 6 times less or 6 times more. So you take that 5,715-year half-life and you can multiply that by 6 and divide it by 6. That's the range where it's reliable, which is why there's so much dispute over the Shroud of Turin, because when the JPL team radiocarbon dated 4 square inches of the shroud, it came back 13th century AD. that puts it just outside the range of reliability for carbon-14 dating. It's too soon. But their response was, based on our date, it can't be from the first century AD, because if it was, we would get a reliable date. But the fact that we didn't get a reliable date and it came in at that great youth, that puts it just outside the range. Now, however, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory team came back and said, we can give you an accurate radiocarbon-14 date, but we're going to need a really big sample. Okay? Give us a square foot, and if it's 13th century, we'll get an accurate date. And the whole point is, after six half-lives, there's just not that much carbon-14 that you can use. So we really need more. Well, the people who own the shroud says there's no way we're giving you a square foot. Because the problem with carbon-14 dating, you lose the sample when you're done. The analysis means you're going to consume the sample. And so they're on. That's why it's still a controversy, because they just haven't been able to do the appropriate date. Well, the problem with human origins is you're typically trying to date stuff that's older than 30,000 years. And moreover, if you're using carbon-14 dating, no matter what you date, it's going to come in at least 58,000 years. And, you know, I was just over at Lake Avenue where there was some discussion about the reliability of radiometric dating, because young Earth creationists, for example, say, you know, we date stuff that you scientists say is 2-3 billion years old, and with carbon-14 it comes in at 58,000. Everything's going to come in at 58,000 with carbon-14. You want to know why? Because one way you can get carbon-14 is that cosmic rays will impinge the nitrogen-14 and transform into carbon-14, and it'll decay back into nitrogen-14. Well, not only do cosmic rays make carbon-14, so does the decay of uranium and thorium make carbon-14. So, for example, if you've got a coal deposit that's 300 million years old, it will have nitrogen in it, but it's also going to have uranium and thorium in it. And that uranium and thorium decay will transform some of the nitrogen into carbon-14. Not very much, but it will transform some. Likewise, you can have zircons that are 4 billion years old, but guess what? Inside the zircon, you've got some nitrogen. You also got some uranium and thorium, and that will make some carbon-14. So anything from the crust of the Earth, if it's really old, will have a carbon-14 date of 58,000 years. And, you know, just look at the literature. You'll see it. That's what's called the background level. Well, because of that background level, carbon-14 is useless to date anything older than 58,000 years, no matter how big of a sample you got. It won't matter. Everything's going to come in with that residual date. For that reason, people trying to date cultural remains from early humans are forced to use what's called optical luminescence and thermal luminescence. And, you know, this is simply material that phosphoresces. I think I've told this story in the class before, where I bought some phosphorescent plastic stars and put them on my son's ceilings, because I wanted them to be able to figure out where north is by looking at the north, the Big Dipper and the North Star and all that kind of stuff. And so, you know, you turn the lights on, and when they turn off, they glow at night. And so when I put them to bed, the stars are all glowing on their ceiling. But after about an hour, the phosphorescence decays away, and then it's black. And so that's how I figured out whether they had their reading lights on after I put them to bed. Because if I could still see the stars, then I knew they had their reading lights on. So, because the decay time hadn't happened. Well, anthropologists, cultural anthropologists, do this, physical anthropologists, pardon me, will do this with ancient human remains. And for that matter, the remains of Neanderthal. They will look at the degree to which phosphorescent minerals within the vicinity or the sample have stopped emitting light. And that kind of gives them an idea how old that sample is. However, it's kind of like what happened in my son's bedroom. It depends how much illumination has gone on those minerals and whether or not the light got turned on or turned off. In other words, if something happened to bury out of the sample where it was cut off from light, that's going to give you a different date. And so a famous example was, in fact, I got called in the carpet by young earth creationists saying, hey, you're claiming that humans went into Australia around 40, 50,000 years ago, but the Jimnian Cave says 60,000 years ago. And you know, I pointed out 20 years ago, well, that's an optical luminescence date, and it may not be that reliable. Well, they actually found something in Jimnian Cave in the same sample where they were able to give a carbon-14 date. It came back 3,000 years. The optical luminescence date was off by a factor of 20 times. And so the bottom line is, with thermal luminescence and optical luminescence, the dates you read in the literature, they're upper limits. It's that date or less. And it could be a lot less. Now, the one difference is this. If you get a sample where you can use optical luminescence and with different minerals use thermal luminescence, you now got two different decay methods with two different decay times. And so in that case, it won't be as reliable as carbon-14 dating, but it's going to be a whole lot more reliable than if all you got is optical or all you got is thermal. But it's really rare where you got both. So the bottom line is, it's probably not a good idea to spend much time debating the difference between theistic evolution and the old Earth creationist model we have at Reasons to Believe with respect to these dates. All the dates that we have for the first humans, and for that matter Neanderthals and Homo erectus, could be off by many tens of thousands of years. Will this get better? Well, if we can actually get more sophisticated, in other words, if you can find minerals that have got different rates of optical luminescence decay and different rates of thermal luminescence decay, if you get enough of that, you can certainly come up with something more reliable. Or if you can get a really big sample and it's less than 58,000 years, carbon-14 might really help. So in some cases, being able to pin down things, for example, and that French cave, that 33,000-year date is considered to be quite reliable because they were able to get enough of the sample that they could get some good carbon-14 dating. It's not as accurate as we'd like, but it's certainly a lot better than a lot of the other dates. Yes, Dave?
With all these dates, isn't contamination also a big factor on the air bar? The shroud, obviously, part of the measurement there is that we know that device, that the cloth had been handled a whole bunch, was exposed to a fire, and so the carbon data came back, the error bar has to be very large because the sample they took was from the corner where the maximum contamination is. So does that increase the error bar, the purity of the sample?
Purity of the sample is a big factor, and if you want to read up on this, I have a chapter on radiometric dating in A Matter of Days, where I point out that, because sometimes one critique of radiometric dating, this is especially prominent in the young earth community, they'll say, look at the discordant dates. While it's quite common in the scientific literature to quote three different dates for a sample, and this is particularly true of samples that pertain to human origins, where they recover, say, some kind of a papyrus bowl, and what they'll do is they'll publish a date for what they think the papyrus is. And they'll notice that there's some corrosion on top of the papyrus, some limestone corrosion. And so they will give a date for that, and then they get an average date of the two. And then they publish error bars. And you know what we tell people in A Matter of Days is, if you see three dates with big error bars, you know the researchers are really struggling with contamination. But what they try to do is take a contaminated sample, and a contamination is just where you've got two pieces of stuff that have different dates and they're mixed together and you're trying to separate them. And so they kind of do the best they can, saying, let's do what we can to pull out the papyrus and isolate it from the limestone that's encrusted on this thing and see if we can get a date. But there's always the risk that you've got some contamination there. And you can tell that because the error bar will be big. So, for example, if they're dating something that's like 4,000 years old, that's really close to the half-life of carbon-14. If you've got a fairly decent-sized sample, you should be able to get a date that's accurate to plus or minus 6 months. it's that good. They got a big enough sample. Or plus or minus a year or 2 years. But if they publish a date that's plus or minus 100 years, then you know they're not confident that they were able to isolate, say, the papyrus from the limestone. And likewise, when they're pulling the limestone out, there might be bits and pieces of papyrus in there, but you can tell that because the air bar is too big. The air bar is too big, and you get a good idea, and especially where they try to publish an average. Okay, we just take the whole sample, and here's an average. But it's not discordant dates. It's simply people struggling with a contamination issue. And by the way, they came up with the Shroud of Turin. A lot of people said, hey, we gave you 4 inches from this place where we think contamination is the biggest problem. And the JPL team came back and said, well, what did you do that for? Why don't you give us another four square inches? And so we wanted to give you the 4 square inches where people weren't interested. And said, well, okay, if you really want us to do a good job, give us a sample where you think there's no contamination. You pick it, and give us 4 more square inches, and we'll test it and see what date we get. Or if you really want us to be accurate on this, give us a whole square foot. Well, that's why it's still a controversy, because the people who own the shroud said, no, we don't want to give you 4 more square inches from a site that actually is part of the image, because that would kind of lose its museum value. And we don't want to give you a whole square foot from outside the image. So until that's done, the controversy is really not going to get settled. But that's typically how things are done. Yeah.
From what I understand, right or wrong, I saw a study on this, that corner that they took out has subsequently been shown to have been a piece that was later interwoven into the turn. So therefore, it would in fact have a later
date
than the rest of the travel.
So,
yeah, that really
does. It does, but I think it wouldn't be that hard for them to give the JPL team another 2-inch by 2-inch square and still have something that look good in a museum display. So, in fact, they could give them 2 or 3 samples of that size. So, and by the way, when I say a square foot, it doesn't have to be contiguous. They could take it from different pieces. So, yeah, I personally think they ought to do it and try to get this controversy settled. So, but frankly, I think the 13th century date that they publish has some credibility, because that was the century of the church history where there was the greatest focus on relics from the time of Christ. It's also the same century where the Roman Catholic Church sold 16 tons of lumber from the cross of Jesus. So... So, the whole point was that was a century when there was a lot of money to be made. I mean, they're also selling water from the cup that Jesus drank from. So, it wouldn't surprise me if somebody had wanted to put out some kind of fraudulent piece of cloth.
Well, they were just wanted to make money off of it.
Well, that was a time when that was going on. I mean, today you're not going to fool anybody by saying, here's a piece of wood from the cross of Jesus. But back then, that was a big industry.
The fact that it's not paint or pigment, and it's a negative 3-dimensional image, which would be impossible to produce at that time,
raises some interesting issues. I also remember what the JPL research team said is, if this is 13th century, that was a time when there was a big financial motive and other motives besides to come up with, what people thought were legitimate relics. And they said, if this was really done in the 13th century, they first said technologically it could be done. It wasn't beyond the technology of people at that time. But they said to get something that's that good to what the biblical text says and what people would expect to see, they probably had to crucify somebody to do it. So, again, if they went that far to produce a fraud, it really gives you a good insight as to how bad things were at that time in church history. I suspect they didn't get a volunteer. But, 2,000 people died in the Spanish Inquisition, so. But it's still an unsolved controversy. But I'm of the opinion, you know, let's grab a few more square inches and see what we get. Because, you know, people have been debating this now for over 100 years. It's too long. Let's get this thing settled. Yeah, this gentleman was first, and I'll come back to you. Go ahead, Al.
You were saying that when you were a teacher, or even your teachers, they put you through a lot of pain to get your PhD, so that once you got your PhD, that you didn't have to be tested anymore. The pain was worth it to get to that point. Is that why God is putting us through all this pain, sort of, that we will? I mean, we keep searching and searching, and it seems like once we get to that point where maybe we will have an answer, it'd be all worth it. You know what I'm saying? I mean, it just, couldn't he have just written a how-to book or what it's all about? Well, I mean, I know it's the Bible, but I'm just saying,
Well, you're on to something. I mean, I think you're exactly right. I mean, I remember when my sons were going through their public education, they said, can't you scientists invent a pill that we could pop and we wouldn't have to go to school? And I said, well, you know, there's something about the pain and suffering and training you go through that you can't get with a pill. And if you want to be prepared for a future career, a pill is not going to do it. It's not just what your knowledge you have in your head, because that's what they were thinking. Now, give me a pill that just automatically puts all the knowledge in my head. No, there's also the discipline you need to gain through gaining that knowledge that's important for a career. I mean, do I want to hire somebody that has never been through any kind of training discipline? Because, you know, when they work for me, they're going to need some discipline. So I don't want people that just popped a pill and, you know, got all the knowledge they needed. Well, in the same way, God is purposely putting through a short period of pain and suffering and training because he's preparing us for a future career in the new creation. Now, this is what I noticed when I first read the Bible. What struck me about the Bible as I was reading it in my teenage years, the Bible is the only holy book amongst the world's religions that actually talked about heaven and the new creation in a way that's beyond what we human beings can visualize. And so we're not going back to the equivalent of the Garden of Eden. We're being prepared for something much better. And, you know, what I noticed too is all religions teach that we started off in paradise. All religions teach that we lost paradise. And these other religions teach that God or gods or cosmic forces are on a mission to bring us back to paradise. The Bible's message is different. That God's on a mission to prepare us for something far better than paradise. And because of that, the training is necessary. I mean, as I told my sons, look, if all you want to do is dig graves for dead people, you probably aren't going to need a whole lot of mathematics under your belt or history, education, or science. But if you want a career where you actually are able to, advance human civilization in some significant way, then you're going to need this training. And so I've got a son that's going to go to grad school because he's not done with his training yet. So he's actually signing up for more pain and suffering. So, but he's not satisfied with a career that you could get with a bachelor's degree. He's looking for a career beyond that. Therefore, he's going to go on. So it all depends where you want to go. But yeah, you're on to something. God is purposely putting us through this pain and suffering. Moreover, he's putting us through the most difficult test that's possible in the context of evil. That's what you see in the Garden of Eden. Who did God invite into the Garden of Eden? Not some lowly demon. He brought in the top guy.
The serpent.
Yeah, Satan was the one that God allowed to come into the Garden of Eden because God wanted Adam and Eve to be subjected to the most difficult tests possible in the context of God's creation. But God was also committed to help Adam and Eve and humanity through this most difficult test. And so we pass the most difficult tests then there really is no need to be tested again, which is why we can enter into the new creation with our free will intact. More than intact, our free will is going to be delivered from the shackles of the physics of the universe to be far more expressive in the new creation than it is now. But God knows that none of us will use that free will for evil intent, because we've already been put through that test. That's already happened. Which means nobody gets to go to heaven unless they're tested. And that's something you see in what the Bible teaches about the millennium. For 1,000 years, God locks up Satan. But what does he do at the end of 1,000 years? He releases Satan to test the children born during the millennium. Because everybody must be subjected to the most difficult tests.
When you say test, you mean more tempt, don't you?
Tempt is part of it, yes. Basically, Satan is testing you to see if you really are going to submit your life to full obedience to Jesus Christ. He's saying, you don't have to do that. Just live life your own way. And so that's the kind of test that God is putting each of us through.
Satan walk into the Garden of Eden supposedly as Satan and then turn himself into the snake?
Well, he's an angelic being. Angelic beings can take whatever form they want.
Yeah.
So they can appear as a donkey, they can appear as a snake or as a lion, they can appear as a UFO or a leprechaun. I mean, all that's within their repertoire. They can do all that. So, and they don't even have to appear in physical form. They can just remain in spirit form. So all that's within their repertoire. However, I will say this from my experience, some are better at it than others. Okay, a question here.
Yeah, you know, back to the Shroud of Turin. There shouldn't be any controversy by now. It should be declared a fake. I mean, if it really wrapped the body of God, that should have been self-evident. That should have been something that would be indestructible.
Trademark.
And a trademark, whatever. A stamp made by Jesus or something. The tablets, the Ten Commandments, where are they? You know, they were made by God. They disappeared. The Ark of the Covenant, all those things that God made, where are they? You know, and here we are talking about a
shroud,
a thing that wrapped his body, and there's a controversy over what date it is, or if it was true. I can't imagine that.
Let me share with you why I'm personally skeptical about it. Because if you read the gospel accounts, it talks about how the body of Jesus was wrapped in this linen, and pressed within it was a talent's worth weight of rosin. Talent at a minimum is 75 pounds. That's a small talent. That's a lot of rosin being pressed into these linen strips around his body. The other thing you notice in the gospel accounts is when Peter and John went into the empty tomb, they saw the linen that was wrapped around the body of Jesus. And it said when Peter saw it, he believed in the resurrection right away. Why? Because the procedure, rich man's burial, of wrapping a body in strips of linen and pressing in the rosin sets like fiberglass. And so, yeah, you're looking at about a 3-inch thick fiberglass material around the body of Jesus. And this would go up to the neck, and then there'd be a headpiece. That's what the text says, that Peter saw the grave clothes, the linen, and with the pressed in rosin, and he saw the headpiece. Now, I think what he saw was this. He saw an empty body cast, unbroken. Which means the only way the body could have got out of that thing was through a supernatural resurrection. And so that's why one look, he believed. Because look what he saw. I mean, if you kind of saw a bottle with a thin neck at the top and it wasn't broken, whatever was inside there must have somehow got out. And if you're talking a human body, the only way it's going to get out is if you break the bottle. If a bottle's not broken, there must be some kind of bodily supernatural resurrection. And after all, Peter was a skeptic. And what does the text say? One look, he immediately believed. something profound must have struck him when he walked into that empty tomb.
So therefore, the shroud is a fake, right?
Well, there are scholars who have looked at that and say, okay, it's not the grave clothes. Maybe what happened is that they wrapped the body of Jesus in a single cloth before they prepared his body for burial. Well, it's speculative. Maybe that happened, but you really don't have textual evidence to support that. So, but that's kind of the comeback for people who think the shroud is genuine. My whole point is, I think we can settle this debate by just taking a few more square inches and see what you get. So, and it wouldn't really damage the shroud in terms of a museum piece. And by the way, I don't think Christians should dwell on the Shroud of Turin as a piece of evidence for the resurrection of Jesus. In the sense is, we got far better evidences for the resurrection of Jesus than a disputed piece of cloth. To me, one of the most profound pieces of evidence, other than what I described about Peter, how do you explain the fact that half the population of Jerusalem within a space of a few weeks became serious followers of Jesus Christ?
Half
of them? Half. Yeah.
Why not all of them?
Well, no.
We're talking earthquakes and zombies and
half of them heard.
Here's why you never get all. This is where the Bible is quite clear. Is that the wide is the door that leads to destruction, narrow is the door that leads to salvation. That in terms of people who will submit and come to Christ, there is the problem of human pride. It takes the humility of Job, the humility of Noah, the humility of the disciples of Jesus to receive what God has offered. And the text is quite clear, Old Testament, New Testament, the majority of the human population will be too proud to receive what God has generously offered. And therefore, we Christians should never expect or demand a majority response. Because the Bible is clear, you'll never get that. On the other hand, we should never be satisfied with 0.5%, because the Bible has also made it clear that those who will receive salvation through Jesus Christ will be a large minority. Therefore, I think 25%, 35%, that's the fulfillment of the Great Commission. And one text you can go to is Zechariah 13. Zechariah 13 speaks about the fulfillment of the Great Commission for the Jewish population. It says a third of them will recognize the one that they have pierced and say, it was Jesus of Nazareth we crucified. He was the Messiah. So it's a prophecy that a time will come in the future when one Jew out of three will acknowledge that 2,000 years ago or whatever, it was this man on the cross and they were the ones that did it, and they'll repent and become Christians. Hasn't happened yet, but that's a prophecy. Now, my argument is this. If the rule of thumb is one-third for Jews, chances are it's that way with the Gentiles. And by the way, the Bible also predicts when the full number of Gentiles have been reached, then God's going to go after the Jews. And so when we have a third of the Gentiles following Christ as Creator, Lord, and Savior, this is when I think we can look forward to a third of the Jews becoming Christians. But we're not there yet. But it's definitely within reach. Last statistics I looked at place the number of people on planet Earth who not only call themselves Christians, but are visibly involved in trying to reach other people for salvation through Jesus Christ is at 17%. Highest it's ever been in human history. Which means it's within reach that we could get to that 25 to 35% level. In fact, missiologists have made the point that could be done in 5 years or less. So it's within reach.
God doesn't want everybody going to heaven? Is that what you're saying?
God desires everybody to go to heaven, but he's not going to force you to go. Let me put it this way. Jesus of Nazareth, the creator of the universe, died on the cross, paid the penalty for the offenses of every human being who's ever lived, and said, I am here to trade your moral imperfection from my moral perfection. But he's a gentleman. He doesn't force the gift on you. He waits. He makes the offer and waits. So it's kind of like what I do with my sons at Christmas time. I give them gifts, but I don't open the gifts for them. They have to open the gifts and receive the gifts. And it's their right to say, forget it, Dad. I don't want your gifts. And we all know children have done that. Where, you know, we give them gifts and they say, I want nothing to do with you. They're bitter, and so they won't touch the gifts. Well, there are people who are like that with respect to God. They're bitter for how they've been treated in their life. And say, I want nothing to do with you. And so they shun the gift that God has offered. He will not force it upon you. That would make us all robots. He wants free will beings entering into the new creation. And so he makes the offer, but he says it's your choice as to whether you receive it or not. And that's the decision all of us have to make. The offer's there, and I have to be the one that takes that step. By the way, that went through me when I was 19 years of age, reading the Bible, convinced it was true, and but I had to go through a struggle with pride. And I remember praying to God, you know what, I don't think I can do this. You make me a Christian. Mm-hmm. And I prayed that for, 6 weeks. And then finally I realized God was saying to me, you know what, humble yourself. You need to humble yourself. And I'm not going to force this upon you. I'm not going to make you a Christian. It's something you have to want. And that's the night I signed my name in the back of a Gideon Bible, giving my life to Christ. But I didn't really figure it out until I read the Bible through again and realized, okay, God never forces himself upon his people. He always allows them to make the move. Old Testament, New Testament. Same in the Old Testament as in the New Testament. Yes?
In this life, I'm prone to panic attacks. So if I die and I go to hell, I'll be having a hell of a lot of panic attacks? Is that what's going to happen?
For the rest of eternity.
Really? Well, let him force himself on me. I want it. I don't want those panic attacks. But I mean, I can honestly from my heart say that I'm still searching. I just, and that's why I'm saying, does God putting us through this pain or to indecision or what, but I don't want those panic attacks forever. I mean, they scare the hell out of me. So
well, that's a good thing, right? So that's a good thing, right?
Yeah. So I'm inviting him to force himself on me, but I know you have to have the free will. Well, what, pardon the expression, but what schmuck would not accept the offer? I mean, who would want to? You're talking about pride. But still, if there's a difference between heaven and hell, who would want to go to hell? I mean, even if you're the most prideful person in the world, who would want to go to hell?
A lot of people want to go to hell.
But it doesn't make sense. I don't get it.
Well, the reason why there's so many people who want to go to hell is that there's a big price to pay to go to the other place. The only way you can get into heaven is by committing yourself to submit to the authority of the creator of the universe for the rest of eternity.
But that's okay, because it's heaven, it's paradise.
Yeah. If you're comfortable with submitting to the authority of the creator of the universe for the rest of eternity, well, great, you're in.
Well, I saw
this. No, that's the key component. Because there are many people, I mean, the Pharisees, for example, they knew who Jesus was. They knew exactly who he was. What was their response? We will not have this man rule over us.
Right.
They wanted to be in charge. They wanted to call the shots. And they were offended that this carpenter was basically saying, look, I'm God. I've proved I'm God. And this is what I want you to do. I want you to humble yourself before me and take direction from me. And they said, we're not going
to
do that.
I have to, just real quick, there's an Orthodox Jew that had invited me over for dinner at this place. And I was talking to him about Jesus and others, and he actually said this. He said, well, first of all, Jesus had a big nose. Well, he was Jewish, but he had a big nose. He was ugly, and he was a hunchback. That's what he said. Now, first of all, who cares? I mean, it doesn't say anything about Messiah looking good. I mean, this I found it very, he's an educated man, and yet he's throwing this stuff at me. And then I Facebooked a guy who was an assistant rabbi, and I said, why don't Jews really believe that Jesus was the Messiah? Can you send me back some info? And he never emailed me back. I mean, I just, you know, I think it's a conundrum, or whatever you call it, irony. It's prophesied that the Jews will not accept them, and that's exactly what's happening. So, I guess that's the answer.
Well, let me give you another argument for why I believe that the Shroud of Turin is probably not a genuine artifact of the image of Jesus, is that we have images of Paul, for example, and we have one that people think might be a reliable image of Peter, but we got nothing of Jesus. We don't know the size of his nose. We don't know if he was a hunchback. We don't know how tall he was. I think for good reason. God did not want an image of his son preserved. Why? Because people would worship that instead of him. So, whereas we have images of, say, the Apostle Paul.
What image do you have?
Well, I mean, there's drawings.
Oh, drawings?
Yeah. And there are people who say, hey, we think this is legitimate. Cause
there's no drawings of Jesus?
Nothing. Nothing of Jesus. And if the shroud were, quote, the genuine artifact, then guess what? As it is, a lot of people are worshiping the shroud anyway.
So these pictures we see of Jesus are just human interpretation of what he might look like.
We don't know the color of his hair. We don't know what his eyes were.
I mean, portraits.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's all kinds of portraits of him. But the truth is, we have no idea what he looked like. On the other hand, I think we've got good evidence that he probably wasn't a hunchback. After all, you know, given the death he went through on the cross, he had to be physically very robust. Someone who had a serious physical defect wouldn't be able to go through the suffering he went through. Moreover, that's actually written in the Levitical law, that a man could not serve in a high priestly role if he had physical defects. And so, for Jesus to take the role that he did, he would have to be free of those defects. But we have no idea of the size of his nose, or the color of his hair, or what his eyes were, or how tall he was. We don't know.
Didn't have power tools back then also, so a carpenter had to be in good shape. No more questions or comments? We need to.
Well,
thank you.
Oh yeah, we're out of time. I'm sorry. I'll take one real quick. Yeah, go ahead.
The New Testament does speak of his appearance, though. That it says somewhere, looking for it, that he was not particularly attractive.
Right.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, it's in Isaiah.
Oh, it's in Isaiah?
Yeah, Isaiah says that you know, he's not so handsome that people would fall him just because of his great looks. But likewise, he wouldn't have been a man with great defects. And maybe that's where your rabbi friend tried to get the hunchback thing from. May have been from the book of Isaiah. In which case, he needs to read the rest of that chapter. Okay, let's bow for prayer. Father in heaven, we do thank you that you have given us substantial evidence, even overwhelming evidence, Lord, that there was a man called Jesus from the city of Nazareth that lived a life of which no one could point any fault or defect or sin. And Lord, this uniquely perfect human being, morally and perfect in every way. We also have evidence that he did die on the cross and he did rise from the dead. There is no body that anyone can recover to say this is the dead Jesus. Lord, we thank you that we have today that substantial historical evidence. And Father, I pray that you would give all those people we meet that we share a Christian faith with, Lord, that you would intervene and give them the necessary humility that they could receive the truth that this evidence points to. Lord, that they would see the advantage of submitting their life to one who knows better than they do what's best for them, rather than trying to live life as they see fit. And Father, we pray too for all those unbelievers out there who are struggling with bitterness, struggling with the life that they've been put through, the suffering and the pain. And Father, I pray that you would open their eyes to see that under your control, all these things can work together for good. And you promise that if we follow you and love you, they will work together for good, everything we go through. So Lord, I pray that you would help deliver the people we share our faith with from that bitterness, that their heart may be opened to receive the humility that they need to receive you as Lord and Savior, and receive the guarantee of entry into the new creation for the rest of eternity and relationship with you and God's people. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.